All right, tonight, our final study in the book of Daniel. This, by my count, is study number 82 in Daniel, and the final one. And we've been camped in Daniel now for 2.5 years. And I kind of have a similar feeling at the end of this book that I did, maybe not quite as strong as I did for Ephesians, but when we finished the long study, it was actually 5 years in Ephesians. When we finished that study, and I came to the last verse of the last chapter, I had a very strong sense of, I really would like to start all over from chapter 1, verse 1, and reteach it, because now that I've taught the whole book, I understand it even more clearly than when I started. And I had just a glimmer of that for Daniel, but then I quickly came to my senses and realized, better not, Yeah. It's been an amazing study for me. I don't know how amazing it's been for you. Going through it, as you can imagine, the responsibility of teaching the book, requires me to understand what I'm presenting to you before I present it. So it. There were many portions of Daniel that I already understood, but there were some that, as I encountered them now, having to be accountable to every single verse and every phrase in every verse. There were some really excellent moments for myself in my own studies, moments of new understanding, moments of greater clarity, and it resulted for me in an overall much greater appreciation for the book of Daniel than I had before. I'm so glad. I appreciate Bob kind of pushing the issue 2.5 years ago to kind of ramrod us into the position of doing this study. And I know some of you have never forgiven Bob for that. But, for me personally, I'll just say thanks. That was great. And I am glad you did it. I was really hesitant starting the book. And I had told you this at the very beginning. I was hesitant for two reasons. One, I knew it would be a challenge for me to teach, but also knew it would be a challenge for you, even if I taught it right and I taught it accurately and I taught it spiritually and truthfully, that it would still challenge you to sit through this particular kind of study. Some of it much easier. Some of the material in the first half of the book, the stories, the famous events that we're familiar with, much easier to grasp. But especially now, we've just been camped in the second half of the book, the more challenging portion, the prophetic portion of the book. And, I knew it would be a challenge as we were slogging through chapter 11. I thought back to that many times. I'm glad we made it through. I hope you didn't get lost in the sauce. I hope you didn't completely lose your way as we went through the book. And I hope that there's something that you gained from it, something that in your heart, even if it's not like I get every specific point, even if it's more just an overview perspective about how the Lord has chosen to preserve this information for us in the book of Daniel and how it's meant to affect your perspective and your relationship toward Him and your perspective in terms of His relationship, the Lord's relationship to His world and to history as we should understand it, not just as it's generally taught in the school system. Let me share with you before I go through some of the details of the book. As I was thinking back, if you were to ask me, what is the most important thing you personally gained from doing this study in the book of Daniel? And I would answer that question two ways. I would say, in a wide view perspective, what I gained, even though I was rock solid for myself in the perspective of God's sovereignty over the world and over history, I gained a deeper appreciation for God's sovereignty and a greater respect for just how sovereign God really is over history, over the nations, and over the rise and fall of nations and kings throughout history. We as believers rightly have the perspective that, or we should have the perspective that God is in charge of this world in which we live and God is in charge of history. But exactly what that looks like can be described a lot of different ways depending upon which teacher and pastor you happen to be listening to. And for me, this book just really drove my heart's perspective to an even deeper level of understanding about just how much God really is in charge of his world and history as he has planned it out and as he is working out his purposes in history. The second thing that I gained from the book that I didn't really anticipate, that was a great personal blessing to me, is a narrower view, not so much looking at the big picture of history and prophecy, but a more narrow view of just Daniel himself as a man. Kind of just walking in his shoes for the 60 to 70 years of his story that this book encompasses. Understanding how he came to Babylon as a young man, 20 years old, and having lost everything, having lost his life as he knew it, lost his freedom, lost his nation, lost his culture, lost his language, lost the freedom of religion that he enjoyed when he was in his homeland, and was, by the purpose of the king of Babylon, absorbed into Babylonian society, culture, language, philosophy, and education, and how he remained faithful from that tender age of somewhere around 20 years old and continued consistently faithful for the next 60 to 70 years of his life, and the awesome fruitfulness that we know from his story. We know from his book the awesome fruitfulness that the Lord brought through his life simply because he remained faithful to the Lord. He trusted the Lord. He obeyed the Lord. And in what we would consider to be an almost impossible life circumstance, the Lord accomplished awesome and amazing things through this one man's faith and one man's faithfulness. That was a great blessing to me personally to just kind of connect with Daniel in an identification kind of way at a level that I had not before. What I want to do tonight is I want to take you through kind of a brief review of the entire book, all 12 chapters, and I just picked some highlights out of our many studies. Of course, I'm not going to be able to shoehorn 82 hours of Bible study into 1 hour tonight, but there are some particularly important points that I don't want you to lose as we move on and we're done with the book of Daniel and we're moving, by God's grace, we're moving on into the book of Hebrews soon. I hope these are perspectives that you've gained, you'll hold, and will remember in your heart and in your own perspective as you go forward with whatever Bible study the Lord has ahead of you in your own future. So let's do that. Let's just cover some highlights from 12 chapters tonight. Does that sound good, everyone? Some of the later chapters, of course, are more familiar because we've just been engaged in them, but all of this stuff critically important. Very first thing from chapter 1 that struck me, and it really struck me when we were doing the study, is that the book opens on a real downer. The book doesn't open with, long time ago things were just rosy between God and his people. It opens in the setting of what identified back then as covenant judgment, that the people of God were in a circumstance of devastation. And they were in a circumstance of devastation because God was holding them accountable as his people. It's not that Israel was the only bad people on the face of the earth or the only disobedient nation. And they may not have even been the most disobedient at that time in history or the most unrighteous. But what they were was they were the most accountable because they were God's covenant nation, and to whom much is given, much is required. That's the nature of our relationship with the Lord. We enjoy the awesome benefit of being in covenant relationship with the Lord, having him pour out his covenant blessings on us. But because he pours those blessings out upon us, he holds us accountable to live in the light of what he has blessed us with. And if we choose not to, if we drift away from our obedience and faithfulness to our covenant relationship with him, he holds us as his people accountable to that. And he was doing so at this time in history. So the book opens with Israel, as I mentioned earlier, devastated. Israel destroyed. Israel is in captivity to Babylon. The Lord has raised up this king, Nebuchadnezzar. He's made him the most powerful king on the face of the earth at this time in history, Babylon being the most powerful nation. And he's placed it in Nebuchadnezzar's heart. It wasn't just a wild idea. The Lord placed in Nebuchadnezzar's heart the idea to go to Judah, the land of Jerusalem, and to conquer that city and to conquer the temple and to lead those people into his homeland as captive slaves to the nation, to the empire of Babylon. And all of that was not because simply Babylon had a bigger, stronger army than the Jews at that time in history. We've known many stories from Bible history, where the Lord led his people to awesome victory against impossible odds. You know, the story of Gideon is just one example. 300 defeated 180,000. 300 defeated 180,000. Do you think the Lord couldn't have preserved Jerusalem against the massed forces of Babylon? He could have, but he chose not to, and he chose not to because his people were being held under the accountability of covenant judgment from the Lord. Now, of course, Daniel and his three young companions are part of those who have been led away into this captivity. And one of the main themes of chapter 1 is the efforts of Babylon to absorb Daniel and his companions into the culture and the education and the philosophy of Babylon. Babylon's goal and the king's goal was to make Daniel fully a Babylonian, to obliterate all of the elements that had distinguished him in his covenant relationship with the Lord, and to make him a full-fledged Babylonian. And of course, there's that interesting early friction between the king's effort and the nation of Babylon's effort to absorb them, and Daniel and his three companions, who are exceptional because they're not the only four individuals among the Jews that have been brought into this captive circumstance. There's a whole generation of young people that are in this similar circumstance, but it's only Daniel and his three companions that remain faithful to their spiritual roots and to the covenant and to their relationship with the Lord. And so in spite of the king's efforts to absorb them, and one of those primary efforts is we studied how Daniel and his companions were renamed. This was a symbolic thing in which they were given an entirely new identity, which was meant to kind of, like a computer would write over old information so that the new information is now the predominant operating system of these young people. And so Daniel himself was renamed from Daniel to Belteshazzar. And we saw that all of the different names that they were given, both Daniel and the companions were given, changed them from names that honored their relationship with the Lord and reminded them whenever anyone would call their name of their relationship with the Lord to names that honored the gods of Babylon. And that with all of these efforts to rename them, to absorb them, to re-educate them, to separate them from all of the old godly influences and to place them under new Babylonian influences, nevertheless, Daniel and his companions resolved in their hearts to remain faithful to the Lord. And this resolve was dangerous because there were no guarantees that if they made this resolve that they would be protected and they would be watched over. In fact, by making this resolve, essentially, remember when Daniel said, I don't want to eat, I don't want to defile myself with the king's table, the food that was being offered to him at the king's table. And he had to appeal to his captors for a special permission to not defile himself and his companions not to defile themselves in that way. And so he wisely offered to be put to the test, he and his companions, for 10 days. And given this special diet, they ate the special diet that was completely different than the king's table. And at the end of the 10 days, of course, they were put to the test. They were personally interviewed by King Nebuchadnezzar himself. And in this interview, they were found, after he questioned them in all the matters of philosophy and governance that he was interested in training them in, they were found to be, by the king's own testimony, 10 times better than all of the other young people of their own culture, and even all of the trainees in the Babylonian education system that were being prepared for this special honor of serving in the king's royal court. So we see that their commitment to be faithful to the Lord and to not compromise was honored by the Lord. And the reason they were 10 times better is not just because they were 10 times smarter than everyone else. It's not because they were 10 times better looking than everybody else. It's not because they were 10 times better talkers than everybody else. They were found to be 10 times better, and it's a very clear implication in chapter 1, because the Lord blessed them for their resolve to remain faithful to the Lord, even under extreme influences to compromise with the culture around them. So this blessing is something that we could describe as a special grace from the Lord for Daniel and his companions. And that grace, while it was apparent and obvious, and it started the story of their adventure in Babylon, it's a grace that continued and sustained them throughout the years of their various adventures ahead. And for Daniel, that extended for another, like we already mentioned, another 60 to 70 years. All right, chapter 2 is, of course, this amazing story of this troubling dream. And the dream is given, interestingly, not to Daniel or to his three companions, but the troubling dream is given to King Nebuchadnezzar. And it's troubling because it's what we identified and defined as a spiritual dream. Not just he had a weird dream and he didn't know what to do with it, but the Lord gave him this dream. The Lord was speaking to him in this dream. As he woke up from the dream, the king didn't know that it was the Lord, the God of Daniel and his companions, that was speaking to him, but the Lord had given him this very specific dream. So when he woke up, we all know the story of how he wanted to get understanding about this dream, and he called all of his wise men, all of his royal counselors to him, and he demanded, put them to the test. He demanded them not just to tell him the meaning of his dream, as they then asked the king, "Well, king, if you will simply tell us what your dream is, we will tell you what the dream means," which is fairly easy to do. You know, I don't know if you have had this experience or not, but if you're under pressure and someone is saying, "Tell me what my dream means," and they tell you what the dream is, you can make up anything you want in terms of this is what the dream means. And as long as you can tell a convincing story, you can get by. But his test was an awesome test. It was a tremendously challenging test, because the test he put his wise men to was not just tell me what the dream means, but tell me what I dreamed, and I'm not giving you any hints. And of course, none of them could answer. And by this time, what was interesting in the story is that Daniel and his three companions are counted among the number of this category of wise men or royal counselors. They're in that group. And so when none of the royal counselors, minus Daniel and his three companions, could answer the king and tell him what he dreamed, he became enraged and did what? He threatened to wipe them all out. He threatened to kill them all, to have them all executed. And so Daniel and his companions were found. They were being prepared to be rounded up for execution. And what I found interesting about that was that while the Lord was setting something up and working through giving this king a dream and then stirring his heart from his frustration of not receiving the answer from his counselors, the Lord is setting the stage for something. But Daniel at first notice doesn't know that. And his companions don't know that. And they're put to an extreme test themselves, which is they have to come up with this answer or they're going to die. And so Daniel wisely appeals to the authority in that circumstance and asks him for a little bit of time to seek the Lord. And so he and his three companions go and do what that night? They pray. And they pray in a very specific way. They're not just praying a broad, general, oh Lord, you know, help us or Lord bless us. They pray in a very focused, very specific way. And they're asking the Lord to reveal to them what they need to satisfy the king so that they are not executed. And the Lord answers in a very specific way. And that answer was, the Lord gave to Daniel in a vision the exact same scene that King Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his dream. And so now Daniel says, okay, I can go and I can resolve the king's concern. And he goes and he meets with the king and he tells the king exactly what the king has dreamed. And we spent some time on this. The substance of the dream was that Nebuchadnezzar had seen a great image. And that image was the image of a man. It was a giant statue that he saw. And that statue had four components, four parts, which had to do with the head and shoulders, and the head first, excuse me, then the shoulders and arms. Then the midsection, and then the legs and feet. And each one of the sections of this giant statue that the king saw in his dream and that Daniel saw in his vision was composed of a specific element, a metal. The head was made out of gold. The shoulders and arms were made out of silver. The midsection was made out of bronze. And the legs made out of iron, and the feet iron mixed with clay. All right? And what we saw in our study through this great image, we saw that this wasn't just an interesting dream, as again, this is a spiritual dream, it's a prophetic dream, and it was a dream about the progression of world empires, world dominating empires, in a specific era of Old Covenant history. And we saw that these empires stretched from the time of Daniel as this event is happening forward all the way until Christ, till the arrival of the Lord Jesus. So the Lord, using imagery, was speaking prophetically to King Nebuchadnezzar, who was associated with the first part, the head of gold, and speaking to him about the progression of world empires in history from that present moment in history until the arrival of Christ into the world. And this head of gold was associated with Babylon. The shoulders and arms is associated with the combined dual empire of the Medes and Persians. Midsection of bronze, the Greek Empire, and the legs of iron and the feet and of iron and clay, the final empire at the time of Christ, the Roman Empire. All right, so we spent some amount of time describing the progression of these empires. But what was particularly fascinating about this dream image that the Lord gave to Nebuchadnezzar was not just the image itself, but the destiny of the image. What happens to the image at the end of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. And that's the particularly troubling aspect of the dream. Remember, this is a dream that the Lord gave to Nebuchadnezzar that caused him to be so troubled in spirit that he lost sleep. He couldn't go back to sleep. He had to have an answer. He had to understand what was going on here. It wasn't just that there was this wonderful giant metal statue of different metals that troubled him. That actually was something that he enjoyed. We'll see a little bit later in the book that that's something that he even attempted to duplicate in real life. What was troubling was what happened to the statue. And in the dream, who remembers what happens? There is a stone that is not cut out of the earth by the action of any human hand. So that tells us it's a spiritual stone. It is, in essence, a heavenly stone. And that stone appears in the dream and strikes the statue. And it strikes it in one specific place on the statue. Who remembers where it strikes it? Strikes the feet. The stone strikes the feet of the statue, which represents the Roman Empire. And when it strikes the feet, it's not just that the statue now has a damaged foot. It strikes the feet, and when it strikes the feet, the entire statue crumbles. And then what happens after it crumbles? Turns to dust, which implies it's not just a light blow that, you know, you can then take the pieces of the statue and kind of glue them back together. This is a complete destruction and devastation of the statue. And then the wind comes along and blows the dust away off of the stage of history. And this still doesn't end. And that's, even though that's probably the part where Nebuchadnezzar was really struggling and getting troubled, but the dream continues, and the stone which struck the statue, apparently fairly small in relationship to the size of the statue, the stone grows. And how big does it get? It grows into a mountain. And you think, okay, well, that's pretty significant. That stone grows into a mountain, but then the mountain continues to expand until the mountain fills the entire earth. Which implies that what started as a single stone eventually dominates the entire world and dominates the entire earth. Okay? Now, while we're looking at this prophetically, and all the details are not given a full explanation at this point in the story, what we understand is that the statue composed of these four components, these four different elements, relates to these four world-dominating empires from Daniel until Christ, and Christ himself is the stone that strikes the statue. He doesn't strike it with a military kind of strike. He doesn't strike it in a natural way. He strikes it spiritually because this is a spiritual stone. And he devastates and destroys the world-dominating empires, the kingdoms of men. And then that stone begins to grow into a mountain. The mountain then is identified as what we call the New Covenant Church. And the church continues to grow and expand, taking on, of course, the likeness of the stone itself until it fills the entire earth. And this isn't just the church. This is overall now a picture of a kingdom and a specific one. The dream is all about four world-dominating empires, so we identified this as the fifth kingdom. Even though it's not called the fifth kingdom, it's an appropriate and common terminology in studies of the book of Daniel, because it's the replacement kingdom to the four that were represented in the statue. What's unique about the fifth kingdom, besides it being spiritual versus cultural, spiritual versus military, spiritual versus geopolitical, is that these four have a God-ordained and appointed period of existence, and then they come to an end, a crashing, crumbling, grinding into dust and blowing away end. But this fifth kingdom, once it's established, never ends. All right, that's chapter 2. Chapter 3. I'd like to spend the rest of the night just talking about chapter 2, but let's go on to chapter 3. All right, chapter 3 starts with an interesting effort by King Nebuchadnezzar, having had this troubling dream, and Daniel's explained it to him, and so now he gets back to sleep, and some time passes, and he now tries to, in a way that causes us, or should cause us, to scratch our heads and draw the conclusion that he never really got the point of the dream, because he turns around and he tries to build a giant statue out in one of the great plains of the land of Babylon, a statue made entirely of gold, a statue really which is to his own honor. And it's the statue that he then calls everyone, all of the great leaders and governing officials in his kingdom, to come and to gather for the dedication of this statue. And they're not just there to applaud, and they're not just there to heap praise upon Nebuchadnezzar in a political way. They're required to, at the sound of the dedication, they are required to do what in relationship to this statue? They're required to bow down and to worship at the feet of the statue, which is in essence saying, we are worshiping you, King Nebuchadnezzar. And so what we saw in our study at the beginning of chapter 3 was that this was an interesting day of unified worship. Meaning the entire nation, and Babylon here really representing the world, as the world is outside of covenant relationship with the Lord, the entire world was united under one single banner. And they were united in a common goal to worship. The only problem with their worship, and we typically think of worship as always being good, and unity is always good, and when you combine good worship and good unity, it's got to be even better, unless the object of that worship is the wrong object. And of course, to worship man or any of the works of man is missing the entire point of worship. And so there's this unified worship, and there's a threat that's issued. Anyone that fails to participate in this unified day of worship will be instantly cast into a fiery furnace, which was also built right next to the statue. Of course, the furnace was what they used to help build the statue, and they kept it stoked so that as the statue was dedicated, anyone that refused to bow down would be introduced not to the statue, but to the furnace that had made the statue. And we have in this story three individuals, the three companions of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to compromise, refused to bow down. And they did so in a very bold but very wise way, in which they said, we're not going to bow down. Our God will deliver us, but even if he doesn't deliver us, there's no way we're bowing down, because we're going to remain faithful to him. He's the only one that deserves to be worshipped and given honor in this particular way. When they respond like that, of course, how does King Nebuchadnezzar react to their refusal to bow down to his statue? He becomes greatly enraged against them. And in order to make a point, he orders for the fire in the furnace to be heated a little bit hotter than normal, 7 times hotter. Now, that's all symbolic, of course. I mean, it really did happen, but the point being that even at just its normal hotness, that would be enough to kill an individual. But he heated it 7 times to make a point about how enraged he was at their refusal to bow their knee and to go along with this unified day of celebration in honoring him and worshiping him. And so the three are bound. They're carried to the edge to be cast into the furnace. The soldiers that carry them there or lead them there themselves are killed by just being that close to the furnace, and the three fall into the furnace, and as they're in the furnace, we look through the eyes of the observers and King Nebuchadnezzar himself and notice that there is a fourth individual in the furnace. And that fourth individual is identified as an angelic or divine kind of being. We identify that individual as being the Lord himself, and they are all four of them, because of his presence, they're seen walking in the fire. So King Nebuchadnezzar calls for them to come out of the fire. They come out. The fourth man doesn't come out with them, which also clearly indicates that we're dealing with a spiritual presence here, an angelic or divine presence. And as they come out of the fire, what does King Nebuchadnezzar do? He gives testimony to not himself and his greatness as the day started. He gives testimony, interestingly, to the greatness of the Lord who has saved these three individuals. It's a significant and notable miracle, one in which the scene itself is telling us how much the Lord had set this entire circumstance up. All of the leaders of Babylon are there for this great event, and this notable miracle is done in their presence and in the presence of the king. So the king testifies about the Lord, and then the king does something beyond just testify. He does a significant thing by issuing a decree, a royal decree. That royal decree is sent out to all the known nations of the earth, all of the nations under the influence of Babylon and in relationship to Babylon, and it's a decree in which he is honoring the God of the three individuals that survived the fiery furnace, and requiring all who were under his authority to respect that God and the people that are committed to that God. All right, chapter 4. Chapter 4 starts with an additional message from King Nebuchadnezzar. And it starts kind of in the middle of the story. We open the chapter with the king writing down and publishing a message to the nations. And then the story, as the rest of the chapter unfolds, kind of takes us through an explanation of why he's sending this message out and what this message is all about, really. And it's an additional experience that he's had, another troubling dream, a second troubling dream. This is what we call the tree dream. Earlier, he had had the dream about the great image of a giant statue with four different metals. This time, he sees this tremendous tree, and there are these strange figures in the dream that are identified as watchers, who we know as angelic beings, and they issue a decree that something's to be done to this great and significant tree. What's to be done with this tree? It's to be cut down. And there's only a stump left. Only a stump remains of the tree. And that stump even has metal bands placed around it so that it's not just devastated, but it's constrained by these metal bands that are placed around it. And, of course, the king is equally troubled by this dream as he was by the prior dream in chapter 2. And he sends, and kind of, it's kind of a repeat of the circumstance of chapter 2. He sends for all of his royal counselors again, obviously missing the point that he should have learned from his first experience when he had asked for all the royal counselors to come with the first dream. How many of them were able to give him a satisfying answer? Only Daniel. And so Daniel is among his counselors, but in this circumstance, Daniel comes in last rather than if you're smart and you've learned something, who would you send for first? You'd send for Daniel to answer about the dream, but Daniel comes in last after once again the philosophers and counselors of the king have failed to tell him about the dream and the meaning of the dream. Daniel comes in, and by the grace of God, he has been given understanding about this dream once again, and he essentially tells King Nebuchadnezzar that the king is the tree. And really, the dream is a prophetic message from the Lord to the king about his own future, and that he is about to come under judgment from the Lord. And the Lord is going to take him through a very unique experience that's going to teach him a deep, lifelong lesson. So Daniel leaves that night, and a year goes by. Nothing happens. And the king is just enjoying life as he's normally accustomed to enjoying it. And one night he's out, kind of enjoying the glories of his own palace and his kingdom and all that he's built. And suddenly he hears a voice from heaven speaking to him, saying, essentially, now is the time for the fulfillment of this dream. And what happens to Nebuchadnezzar is what? What goes on? He loses his mind. What we would call he undergoes a regression of his mental faculties. He goes insane. He becomes like a beast among men. He's excluded from Babylonian society. His hair grows to amazing lengths. His nails grow, and he lives and functions like a beast for 7 years that he's under this judgment of the Lord. And this was predicted and prophesied for him in the dream, but he didn't get it, and he didn't make the necessary adjustments before the experience actually happened. One of the things we learn from this is some people can only learn by experience. I mean, the Lord had spoken to him very specifically. The Lord had spoken to him very clearly in advance, but he had to go through the experience because of the hardness of his heart. And so he goes through this 7-year period, and at the end of this 7-year period, the Lord had ordained that it had an end point, just like he had ordained that it had a beginning point. And the text tells us that he suddenly came to his senses. He looked up toward heaven, and his reason returned to him, and he was restored to his right mind. And when he was restored to his right mind, did he begin to cry out in bitterness and anger toward God, who had ordained this 7 years of judgment for him? He has exactly the opposite kind of reaction response. He praises God. Even though God ordained this judgment for him, he praises God because he recognizes for the first time one of the key elements of the entire book. And let's look at those verses together. In the very first studies we did in Daniel, I identified a couple of the verses from chapter 4 as what I call the key verses of the entire book. So let's read these three verses in chapter 4. The first one is in verse 17, and this is when the dream is first being explained to him. It says, "The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. And look down in verse 25. That you shall be driven from among men and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And you shall be wet with the dew of heaven and 7 periods of time shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And then the final occurrence in verse 32 of chapter 4. There's one more in chapter 5, but I'll just read these three. Certainly makes the point. Verse 32, and you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. So why did the Lord take Nebuchadnezzar through this experience? To teach him one very hard lesson. And that is, you're not in charge, I am. The Lord was teaching him, you're the king of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth, and I can take that away from you just like I gave that to you. You need to wake up, open your eyes, and see that it's the Lord, the Most High, who rules over the kingdoms of men. Now keep in mind, and this is to me one of the critical lessons of the entire book, Babylon is not a covenant nation. They don't recognize the right of Yahweh to rule over them. They had their own gods that they worshipped and honored, and King Nebuchadnezzar, for the most part, worshipped himself. And yet the Lord was imposing this lesson on Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar didn't ask for this lesson. He didn't want this lesson. It was a 7-year long, hard lesson in which he lost everything. But once he learned it and his eyes were opened and his heart was awakened, he recognized that the Most High truly was in charge. And he ended up at the end of the chapter praising the name of the Lord for what the Lord had taught him. All right, chapter 5. Chapter 4, of course, ends the story of Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 5, we pick up with a new king, and the new king is no better than the old king. This is now King Belshazzar, and in this story, King Belshazzar throws this amazing feast in his own honor. He throws it for all of the royal officials and leaders of his kingdom, and includes his army in the feast. And we went through some detail of how expensive this feast was. And I mean, literally, he spent a king's fortune to throw this feast. And while he's celebrating in this feast with all of his assembled people there with him, he gets this bright idea, which, of course, was not bright at all. But in his own mind, he thought it would only magnify his reputation in front of his court. And that is, he calls for all of the furnishings from the temple that had been ransacked by Nebuchadnezzar in an earlier generation, the temple in Jerusalem, the temple of the Lord. He called for all of the vessels, like the goblets, the things that were used in the service of the Lord, to be brought in, and they filled them with wine, and they toasted one another, and they celebrated essentially it was a symbol of their dominance over this people that they had captivated, that they had captured and conquered. And right in the middle of their celebration, the Lord interrupts the feast. And he's the uninvited guest at the feast. And he interrupts in kind of a spooky way in which only a hand appears in the room and begins writing a message on the plaster of the wall of the palace. And it's a mysterious message. Many, many tekel upharsin. And the king is kind of mystified by the message, and we have a repeat again of, I need to learn about what this is all about. It wasn't a dream, but it was an experience that he needed someone to explain to him. None of his royal counselors could explain it to him, and the queen mother remembered Daniel and recommended Daniel to the king as someone who was a solver of spiritual mysteries. And so he sends for Daniel, and Daniel comes in. He sees the lettering on the wall. The Lord gives him understanding of the meaning of the lettering, and he very boldly says to the king, this experience has all happened because of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, and you were meant to pay attention to what the Lord did with Nebuchadnezzar, how the Lord dealt with his life, and you were meant to learn from that so that you would not follow his bad pathway. You could avoid that, but you ignored all of those lessons, and now the Lord is dealing with you just like the Lord dealt with Nebuchadnezzar. And the let me write this down, handwriting on the wall, of course. And the message is translated and applied to him. And the message, many tekel upharsin, was, does anybody remember what the meaning of that message was? Sorry, what? Okay, it was weighed. What's the third word here? All right, hold on a second. Let me just reference my third word. Oh, no, first one is what I missed. Numbered. Weighed and divided. And the meaning, as Daniel applied it to Belshazzar, was simply this. The Lord has been holding you accountable. The Lord has been evaluating. The Lord has been numbering your days. He's been weighing out your actions. And he's found you lacking. He's held you accountable and you do not pass the test. And so you are being divided from your role as king and from your kingdom. The kingdom is essentially being taken away from you. And later that night, the king fell down dead. So what we learn from this example, of course, is the same lesson that was taught to Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord, the Most High, is ruling over the kingdoms of men. Now, what the Bible asserts and insists that we understand as his people is that no one who holds a position of authority in any human government gets there purely by their own design. If they hold a position of authority and responsibility, they're there because the Lord has placed them there and appointed for them to hold that position. And he is weighing all of their decisions and all of their actions. And he will ultimately hold every one of them accountable for all of their decisions and all of their actions. We may not see in each case as dramatic of an expression of this as we see with this one king, in which he literally dies that very night. But we can be assured that God is numbering, weighing, and dividing everyone in this world who represents his authority and is being held accountable for that purpose. All right, chapter 6. I can leave that on for now. Chapter 6. The story opens with, this is of course the famous chapter of the lion's den. But it opens with a testimony about Daniel, because this is many years later now. He starts as a 20-year-old. Now, in chapter 6, he's closer to 80 years old. And the testimony that we're meant to notice about Daniel, and this is not just what Daniel says about himself. It would be far less powerful of a testimony if it was his own description of himself. But it's the description of those who have observed Daniel over the years. And he is described as having an excellent spirit. And this is really the distinguishing characteristic of Daniel's personal story. The testimony is not that Daniel was an excellent politician. It's not that he was an excellent orator. It's not that he was an excellent administrator, though I think he probably had gifts in all of those areas. What the Lord wants us to notice in Daniel's story, and he's being set forth as an example for us to aspire to be more like, is that his spirit was excellent. And what we mean by that is simply that his character reflected the Lord's character. Now, in that circumstance, we might say, okay, well, Daniel had an excellent spirit, therefore he must have been really, really popular in Babylon. And he must have been really popular with all of his co-workers, all of the men that served alongside of him, because, you know, if you represent an excellent spirit and you live your life under the convictions of the Lord's ways and principles, everyone around you will look at you and admire you and respect you and support you and want to be more like you. But Daniel's experience was exactly the opposite of that. He had an excellent spirit, and those who were in government alongside of him hated him because of it. They were jealous of him because of it. They were envious of him because of it, and they formed a conspiracy to do something about it. And their intention was what? Their intention was to have Daniel taken out, have him murdered. The way they did that was they were smart enough in an evil, devious kind of way to not try to attack Daniel directly, because they couldn't find anything to hold against him. They searched his records. They searched his history. They looked for any kind of compromise. They looked for any kind of violation. They couldn't find anything. So what they did was they created a scenario that they knew that they could trap Daniel in. And that scenario was they went to the king and they convinced the king to have a day in which everyone would essentially have to bow down to the king and honor the king and only honor him. And if anyone chose to worship or honor any god other than the king himself on that day, they would be held accountable, and the penalty for that violation would be death. And in specific, the being thrown into this den of lions. And so when the king made this order, and he made it in such a way that it was a law of the land, could not be revoked according to the laws of the land, what happened was Daniel did what? He went home and he opened the windows of his home, kind of like a balcony kind of circumstance, where he could be seen and observed by those who were specifically watching to catch him in the act. And he prayed to the Lord three times that day in such a way that he could be observed doing so. And knowing full well that by doing this, he was going to bring down upon his head the penalty of the law, nevertheless, he was faithful to the Lord and refused to compromise. So what we see here, if we compare this with his actions in chapter 1, is that the same resolve to not defile himself with the king's table in chapter 1 has not faded in Daniel from 20 years old to 80. He's, if anything, more firmly resolved to not compromise and to fail, to do anything other than to honor the Lord, even as an 80-year-old man. And so he is caught in the act. The king is forced, even though the king likes Daniel, the king doesn't want to harm Daniel, he's forced to throw Daniel in the lion's den. And it's interesting the way the story unfolds. We're not allowed to see any of the story through Daniel's eyes while he's in the lion's den. We're seeing the whole story through the king's eyes as he goes that night and loses sleep because he's worried about Daniel. But interestingly, he expects Daniel to be killed, but he has this glimmer of hope that possibly Daniel could survive the experience. And so he comes out the next morning and he calls out to Daniel in the lion's den to say, has your God been able to save you in this circumstance? And Daniel, of course, answers, and he's brought out alive out of the lion's den. The king flips the script on those that had conspired against Daniel and has all of them and their families taken and thrown into the lion's den in Daniel's place. The story is pretty dramatic in that they don't even hit the bottom of the pit before the lions are on them. And Daniel is brought out, Daniel is honored, and beyond just Daniel being honored, the chapter ends with another decree by the king. This is a different king than Nebuchadnezzar earlier, but the king sends out a decree to all the nations, honoring the God of Daniel. And what we saw was this is in a sense the Lord using the king of the most powerful nation on the earth to evangelize on his behalf, even though that king himself does not fully know the Lord and certainly does not fully believe and embrace the Lord. The Lord has opened his eyes and causes him to send word out to the nations about the one true God of Daniel. All right, that ends the first six chapters. And I'm at the end of my time. So what I may do, next week, as I said, we have the study in the life of Joseph. I may do, 2 weeks from now, I may do a second look back on some of the more complex stuff in the second half of the book. I'll pray about that, and I will consider whether the Lord wants me to do a second review or just leave it with, since we've most recently covered the last six chapters, whether we were just supposed to review the first half of the book. But I'll put it in there tonight because we're at the end of our time. And I hope just kind of revisiting some of those stories was a blessing and a benefit to you. And I hope that when you read back through the book in times to come, you'll remember these main points that we focused on tonight and certainly in more detail in our earlier studies. All right. God bless. And we'll look forward to possibly doing the second half 2 weeks from tonight.